comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I'm here because you have a right to know, and I'm here because you matter. I hope, every weekend is, for a lot of people, it's like a holiday. But here in the United States, we did have a holiday this weekend, meaning we had a long weekend for most people. Most people, when they got off work on Friday, they haven't been back. For most people, that's the way it worked, and it's Labor Day weekend. I hope you have had a safe and very happy Labor Day weekend for those of you in the United States. For all of the rest of our listeners around the world, well, I hope your weekend was safe and fun as well. And it's good to be back and doing the world of the strange and unexplained. I'm glad you're here. I think you're going to be glad you're here as well, because we have a guest with us tonight who's been with us before. And every time he's with us, we always talk about some real front bumper concepts for physics. And we're going to do the same thing here tonight again, and I think you'll enjoy it. His name is Henry Kroll, K-R-O-L-L. If you're not familiar with Henry Kroll, go over to my website. Scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show, and right under it, you will see a link that says Show Info, and you click that, it'll pop up a little screen with some information about him and a link to his book. If you're not subscribed to our K-Files, be sure you get subscribed, because it is free. It's our free weekly newsletter, and we send it out starting every Friday night right after the show. We want you to get it, and you need to be getting it. There's absolutely no genius in sitting in the dark when there is light available, and it's free. So you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. So scoot on over to the website, click where it says K-Files, and subscribe. You know, the Kevin Smith Show is 100% listener-supported. Without you, we are not here tomorrow. Without you, we're not broadcasting, and it's very, very important for you to understand that. If you're not yet a member, we need you to join, but you need what's in that members community as well. Now look, here's what you need to do. If you're not yet a member, click where it says join, and just go through those pages. It's going to be two or three pages that show you what's in the members community and expose you to it. And you'll hear some testimonials there as well from people who are talking about how important it is to be a member. Check it out and then join. It's only $7.50 a month, and that comes out to 25 cents a day. We don't sell advertising here on The Kevin Smith Show. We depend on you. If this show's good enough to be here tomorrow, it's good enough for you to join tonight. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Henry Kroll is, like so many of our guests, a very multifaceted individual. He is a ship's captain. He's a pilot and thinker and researcher and a published author. And his views on the cosmos are really pace-setting and some people would say controversial. Henry is my guest this evening, returning tonight after quite some time away from us. Henry, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you having me on. This is Captain Hank Kroll here. We got a big storm in Kenai, Alaska, right at the present time.
Is that where you're located?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, I hope we don't lose connection, but if we do, I will attempt to call you back and get you back on the line. Now, you said you have a big storm. Now, what kind of storm are you having? I mean, is it like squalls? Is it just lots of rain or a lot of rain and wind? What do you got?
We're right at the present time. We have winds, gusts of between 30 and 40 miles an hour out of the southwest, out of the south. And but anyway, I've written a book titled Cosmological Ice Ages. And in the book, what I do is try to enlighten people using basic logic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a veteran of the king crab industry up here in Alaska. Now, I've fished king crab 25 years, and I don't know if you've seen those TV programs, Deadliest Catch and all that.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I know all those guys. In fact, they were kids when I was fishing. They were in high school. And I put in several million pounds of king crab into Kodiak and also Homer and Dutch Harbor and other places.
How long have you done that?
I fished king crab 25 years, and I tendered salmon for other fishermen 50 years. I've hauled many millions of pounds of salmon. And my personal catch is almost 2 million pounds of salmon.
Well, you know, you've got a lot of years doing what has, for a very long time, been listed as the most dangerous profession, the most dangerous job in the United States and perhaps the world, commercial fishing.
Well, I never thought about it as being dangerous. It was more fun than danger. We really enjoyed it. My brother and I fished together for the first 3 years, and we had a power scow at that time with twin engines, and we rigged it up. That was when I first started crabbing. And we catching these king crab that weighed 12 pounds. Some of them were giants. They had a claw the size of your fist. And anyway, he'd go out on deck half asleep in the morning, open up a pot and reach in there, and I hear this terrible scream. And my hair stood up, so I ran outside to see what was the matter. And he's just sitting there calm in this big 7x pot, and there's a big claw laying over at his side.
So he
reached
got
in there, and the crab got him by the thumb, you know, and kind of.
Yeah. All right. So
anyway, I've seen weather up here that would kill you just to see it for the ordinary person, you know, that's how bad it can get. I've been caught in storms, and I've had to make a run for it back into port many, many times. And I've been lucky. Most of the guys that I fished with are dead now, you know, or died of old age, a lot of them. But they were on boats that were old tuna seiners, old herring seiners out of San Francisco, wooden boats. And a lot of them hit rocks or they sunk from opened up in the weather, you know, bad weather.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, I like to try to reach people through basic logic, you know, just really 2 + 2 = 4 type of logic. We use some mathematics, but it's very, I left a lot of it out of my books. But what I'd like to talk about today, if you don't mind, is carbon.
Yeah, you know, when you and I talked on the telephone the other day, I was fascinated by what you had to say about that. Here on this planet, basically everything that's alive is carbon-based. And you asked me a question that I don't think I've ever been asked. And that question was, did you ever wonder where all that carbon came from on this planet? And I don't think I've ever been asked that.
I don't think our science asks it either. Nobody gets it, you know.
Well, let me tell you this before you dive into it. After you asked me that question, I decided to go online and see what the so-called experts say. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of different theories and different views out there about where all this carbon came from. And none of them rested on anything other than speculation. So I'm very interested in hearing what you have to say about where all this carbon on Earth came from, because all of us are made of it. We're all carbon-based, and everything alive on the planet, I guess, is carbon-based. So I'm very interested in hearing what you have to say about where it came from.
Well, you know, I wrote the book and I plotted our course through space to find out where the Earth and the Sun were born and then what created all the coal, oil, and limestone. But since then, I've done a lot of study and reasoning on the subject myself. Now, you're talking about carbon. If you look over there at your wife or your sweetheart, a diamond ring on her finger is pure carbon. It costs you about 2 months' labor to buy that. And chances are it costs somebody at least 2 weeks of digging around in the dirt to find that piece of rock and then cut it up. Well, carbon is very important on this planet. It virtually makes your car go down the road, heats your house, and you send your children over to fight wars, and they come back missing limbs and in terrible shape because of carbon. And I've discovered some information where the U.S. military the information I got was that the U.S. military alone consumes 53% of the world's carbon oil in the form of oil and other gas and stuff.
That would not surprise me. Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me.
Well, we've got more than 200 military bases, large ones all over the world, all being maintained. We've got aircraft everywhere flying. C-130s and C-175s or whatever those bigger ones are everywhere. They're even flying over my fish sites when I'm fishing salmon. And there's, you know, Osama bin Laden wasn't hiding out there at all, you know. It's ridiculous. And that doesn't count the atomic power that they're using either.
Mm-hmm.
You see, most of the world doesn't even use oil or gas. They heat their food with charcoal and they live in the Africa and tents are in South America, and we're the industrial nation of the world. We are the only ones that really depend on the carbon-based fuels, and we're fighting our carbon wars, and we lost 2,000 in Iraq, and we are over 2,000 now in Afghanistan, from what I hear, just over carbon. So it is a very important subject. It's horrendously important.
All right, so I think probably most people, like me, and you know, I'm pretty much up on all of this stuff within our genre, but I think most people are like me in that they've never considered, well, where does all this carbon, where did it come from? You know, for most of us, here's what happens: we think, well, it's in the ground. Okay, yeah, but how did it get there?
Well, anyway, for one thing, let's look at our own solar system first. We've got Jupiter's moon, Callisto. It has methane seas and also a regular water ice over 200 to 400 kilometers thick. And then we've got Titan's moon of Saturn. It has maybe hundreds of times more oil or carbon on it than we have on Earth. It has methane sees and more liquid hydrocarbons in all known oil reserves and natural gas on the earth. According to research, it's stuff is literally falling from the sky. It's got methane rain. It's got lakes all across the moon, and there's several dozen of them that have more hydrocarbons liquid in the form of methane and ethane than all of Earth's oil and gas reserves. So how did that carbon get there? Well, that's, I like cosmology. I like to study where we came from and how we got here and how stars are formed and basic. So our sun is basically a middle-aged star, and it doesn't produce carbon. It's made of hydrogen and helium, and it's just cooking away there, and you don't get carbon from middle-aged stars. So we had to have come close to some other objects in space where we imported these carbon. Apparently, planets are knocked in and out of orbit all the time. We just don't live long enough to see it. So we could have been flopped in from somewhere else, or either that or we accumulated it from another star that we were captured by. And what I discovered by just plotting our course through space, like you would on a boat or a plane or anything else, I just discovered that there's two astronomers, Campbell and Moore. They tallied up the redshift of 1,249 bright stars, and they determined that we were traveling toward Hercules at 19.5 kilometers per second. Well, if I ran a line backwards through a constellation map through the center of it and extended it out, it winds up in Orion. And if we're leaving Orion, Orion is a birthplace for stars, and it happens to be the nearest birthplace to our solar system. So obviously our sun was born there. This is basic two and two logic. You can't hardly refute it unless you can come up with some other additional information and velocities, you see. So anyway, we're born in Orion. We left there. Earth froze up for a billion years, and it had a really thick carbon dioxide atmosphere when it left the Orion area where the stars are born. Orion's a big place over there, by the way. We could have been born by the Horsehead Nebula, which is on the cover of my book, or any of those areas, and there could have been carbon in the area that we absorbed that atmosphere, and it was the carbon dioxide of 700 pounds per square inch.
Why?
So did you have something to say? I can't hear.
Yeah. Why did we have this thick atmosphere of carbon dioxide as we left Orion?
I don't know exactly. It's just that it was a gas planet, much like Jupiter has an 800 pound per square inch atmosphere, Saturn around 7 something, and you know, it just is formed that way. However, we could have picked up additional carbon from another place that we got captured by. See, we were in that cold Huronian glaciation after we left because it's cold out there in outer space. Earth froze up for a billion years, and we had mild deep sheets over the ocean of ice, and five mile deep sheet of ice on the single continent, Pangaea. So there's no way to get out of that because the atmosphere was so thick that you'd never see the sun. Right now our atmosphere is 14 pounds per square inch, and it's 60 miles deep. And if you wanted to figure out how deep such an atmosphere would be, you would divide 14.5 into 750 pounds per square inch and multiply by 60 miles, and it'll give you a rough idea of 2,800 miles deep atmosphere. Well, even with 14 pounds per square inch, you can't see the sun. Some days, you look outside on a cloudy day, you don't see it. So how would you ever see the sunlight with a thick atmosphere like that? So obviously, the sun did not create life on Earth. It couldn't have pierced the atmosphere. It took something much more powerful than our sun to thaw the ice caps back off the oceans and to get life started during the Cambrian era. And what I did is, between us and our birthplace in Orion, there's two giant stars, and they have a lot more gravity than our sun, And we are actually heading towards Cirrus A and B and Procyon over there. They orbit each other. Each one of those is two solar masses, and then each one has white dwarfs orbiting close to them, which bump their masses up to about three solar masses for Procyon and 3.5 solar masses for Cirrus A and B. And then all the Dogons and the ancient Egyptians and all our ancient ancestors, the Greeks, probably knew all this. They have legends about the 54 Argonauts and the orbit period of Cirrus around Cirrus A around Cirrus B, or they wobble around each other because Cirrus B is 1.5 solar masses. It's this little object, much bigger than the Earth, but it's made out of atomic particles and it has a tremendous mass. And it puts out more than 100 times the UV light of our sun. It's the only thing out there that could pierce our atmosphere. There is nothing else that I could come up with. And we're heading toward it at 7.5 kilometers a second.
Okay, so you're saying that was Sirius B.
Well, it's basically created life on Earth.
But you're saying Sirius B is the one that was able to pierce our atmosphere.
Yeah, and the Cirrus A puts out 4 times the light and heat of our sun, or maybe 6 times, we're not exactly sure on that one. And we got captured by them. The mechanics of it work out quite well, because when you got multiple star systems, if you match the speed of one, it'll put you in orbit around the other. It can be done with computer simulations, but... Anyway, that's what happened, and we got captured by Cirrus, and we're still in orbit around it. We're heading toward it, and you total up the gravity in that neighborhood. You just multiply mass difference times 4, because the galaxy gravity is behind there. It's transmitted to this spiral all the way to this 3 million solar mass black hole in the center of our galaxy. But anyway, we're heading that way. You just multiply mass difference times 4. It's 3.5 solar masses, so it's 14 times the gravity of our sun. And then Procyon is up there a little further away at 10.4 light years, so it would have less gravity. And anyway, the orbit period matches the last ice age. It was 105,000 years. So evidently we get close to it, and the additional light and heat makes all the plants grow like crazy and make a thin layer of coal. And if you go down deeper, the layers of coal are thicker.
All right, we have to step away for a break, Henry. So we'll do that, and then we'll be back right after this. Don't go away, folks.
www.kevinsmithshow.com. Course set for fantastic, Captain. Oh my.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Henry Kroll, and we're discussing where all this carbon came from that makes up all of the all living things on this planet and almost all of our energy sources on this planet. I got a question, Henry, before we go any further. You mentioned that, we, for some reason, got kicked out of the Orion system, and then we got captured by the Sirius system, A and B, and that we are still in orbit around it. Did I understand that correct?
Yes, that's the way I see it.
Okay.
We got captured about 700 million years ago, somewhere in there, 650, 700. About the time we came out of that big ice age, the Huronian glaciation.
And then you said we're headed back toward it. Why is that? That's because we're in orbit around it? Is that the deal?
We're still in orbit around it. We got kicked into an elliptical orbit. We were in a tight orbit at less than a tenth of a light year. And we can compute the amount of light arriving on Earth at one-tenth light year from Sirius B because we know what the output of it is. It's 100 times more UV than our sun. So obviously it would double incoming UV to Earth at one-tenth light year. But what happened is about 3 million years ago, which is sort of yesterday in geologic time, we got kicked into an elliptical orbit, and where we had ice caps on the Earth for the first time in a very long time. We got captured about 650 million years ago, and then a temperature went up to 60 to 80 degrees, average global temperature, and it sort of stayed there. And during the Carboniferous era, it laid down coal 100 feet thick in Pennsylvania, Utah, Colorado, and all over a lot of different places in the world. And that's plant growth. And we're not seeing that type of plant growth right now. So we're not making coal right now. It takes heat, and it takes photons in the right frequency, and it also takes a high-pressure atmosphere of carbon dioxide.
Okay, now...
grew like crazy.
All right, so, you know, we are in orbit around Helios, around our sun. All right, and if what you're saying is correct, then our sun is in orbit around Sirius as well, meaning that's a trinary rather than binary star system, right?
Yeah, Mike, there's another object there also, according to the Dogons in Central Africa. And there's probably water-based planets there. There's a lot of rogue planets out there in space. In a recent astronomy magazine, they found hundreds of them. Just got knocked out of solar systems, these planets that were formed with stars and they're just floating around out there. So we could have got captured by our own sun. You know, there's no really way to tell. But I think we got captured by the Sirius system because the mechanics work out really well. And the amount of layers of stuff we got on Earth, like your coal and your oil and your limestone, correlate with an input of light in the right UV spectra to make the plants grow. And in the oceans, you see, limestone is made by plants.
Why? What do plants do with it?
Limestone. It's made of calcium carbonate. And during the Carboniferous era, it laid down limestone up to 12,500 feet thick. That's a tremendous amount. That was 400 million years ago to about 300. It was about an 80 million year warm period where the temperatures went up on Earth to 80 degrees Fahrenheit, a little over average global temperature. Right now, it's 32 degrees, by the way. We're still in the ice age. It hasn't really changed much in the last 3 million years.
But, well, what about all that global warming?
We came out of an ice age not too long ago, you know. We were brought out of it artificially, I believe. But when our moon was swapped into orbit around Earth, and that was 11,715 years ago, this is determined by two Norwegian scientists studying ice core graphs of ice cores when we came out of the ice age. And this tilted Earth at that time also 23.5 degrees, which has doubled the population of fish in the oceans, increased the arable land by throwing the ice caps back. About 1,500 to 1,800 miles, we had thick ice caps, and our year was 360 days at that time. And we got knocked out further from the sun when the impact hit the Earth. So now we got 365 1/4 days.
All right. Now you said that we are the average. Temperature of Earth right now is 32 degrees.
Yeah, you can go online, Huntsville, Alabama, or NASA, and get all those graphs, because they've got satellites that orbit Earth, or like the little laser gun. They aim at the surface and they average out on thousands and thousands of readings. And it went back down to 32 degrees after the Icelandic ice core or Icelandic volcano went off.
Okay, now my question though is, if the Earth's average temperature is right now 32 degrees, that means by definition we are still in an ice age, but we keep hearing about global warming.
Well, it is warming up slightly, I have to admit, you know, but their governments are making a big deal out of it to limit the number of children you have and the size of house you live in and less oil consumption to make it last longer so they can make money longer, the people that run the oil energy companies.
Okay, so
that's a different topic.
All right, so what you're saying is you don't buy the global warming alerts, alarms, we got to do something or we're all going to fry. You don't buy that.
Well, I could put some of the information in the book, so you can do some of the math, but human activity on Earth contributes very, very little to actual global warming. So there's nothing much that humans can do to forestall global warming, but you know, it'd be nice if we used a different energy source, use electric cars and fuel them with solar cells and other sources of energy, you know, and geothermal. It'd be nice to do that, but they won't do it because they got this energy czars controlling us.
Okay.
The average, you know, we burn 90 billion barrels of oil a day, and as China develops, it's probably getting close to 100 billion barrels of oil per day that we're consuming right now of oil on Earth.
That's all right, so now, if we're headed back toward Sirius A and B, obviously we're not leaving our sun. That means our sun is headed back that way.
Right, the whole solar system.
The whole solar system. As we get closer, we're picking up more UV light, which should be causing warming right across our solar system on every planet.
We're also lining up with the center of the galaxy, the galactic plane, where you've got billions of stars all in a flat area. We got knocked into this weird up and down movement from the galactic plane, I think about 3 million years ago, when the Barnard's Loop explosion went off. That's the only thing, the timeline that correlates with anything that I can discover. I know it's complicated, I'm sorry, but anyway, that's where we're at.
Okay, so originally all this carbon here on this planet was the product of being in the Orion star system, right?
I don't think all of it was. You see, here's the deal. We had a thick atmosphere. It was maybe 20% carbon, and then it was taken down about 50% to maybe 300 pounds per square inch during the Carboniferous era. And at the time of the dinosaurs, it may have been 30 to 60 pounds per square inch. And it was, you know, right now Venus is 117 pounds per square inch in its carbon dioxide. It's closer to the sun than we are. It's a gas planet also. It has an atmosphere that's 500 miles deep, and ours is maybe 50 or 60 miles deep. It's got, you know, 10 times more atmosphere than we have. And it's carbon dioxide. It could be turned into coal and oil, and it could be turned into limestone, but you'd need sunlight or some sort of plant growth. It'd have to be colder. You'd have to take Venus and move it further away from the sun, and then you could see the ocean, so water could exist on the surface if it was a little colder. But anyway, I think some of the carbon came from Sirius B. Sirius B turned into a white dwarf some long time ago, apparently. I looked up on the internet, and the only thing I could come up with for a mass of that size is that originally it was a giant red star of six solar masses. and it exploded and shrunk down to 1.5 solar masses. So in other words, it kicked out about 3.5 solar masses of iron, silicon, and carbon. And a lot of the meteorites that we get, I have this carbonaceous chondrite. It's made of carbon. So I think a lot of some of the carbon probably came from Cirrus B, you know, where we have this dust cloud around it of iron and silicon and carbon, and we've been orbiting through it for 700 million years. It might have picked up some frozen CO2 even, or something like that, probably coming in all the time, chunks of ice. The planets, or the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are like planets, big enough to be planets, are made of methane and carbon. So, you know, I don't know exactly where it came from. I think some of it came from Orion and some of it came from Cirrus B, the remnants of it after it exploded.
Well, you know, one of the theories that I ran across out there,
the stuff that we've taken for granted.
One of the theories I ran across was that
limestone with light in the UV spectrum. It's invisible light that makes plants grow.
Henry, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you now.
All right. One of the theories that I ran across about where all this carbon came from, and this is a theory from academia. It's one of their theories, is that there was a generation of stars that existed prior to our sun that just exploded, and that all this carbon went showering out across the galaxy, and that's how some of it arrived here, and that's how we got it. Now, you know, the problem I have with that is that, first of all, how do they know these stars existed and exploded? That's total speculation. But you talked about 90 billion barrels of oil per day. And on top of that, there are billions and billions of tons of coal used every day. Okay, so that's all carbon-based. You know, to get that much carbon from a carbon shower coming from an exploded star, that was one heck of a shower of carbon, miles and miles and miles and miles and tons of it falling on the earth. I don't buy it. We have to take a break, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Henry Kroll. All right, so when we went away for break, I was saying, you know, imagine the amount of pounding this whole Earth would have taken, and it would have had to have happened over a million years or more for all of that carbon to have been deposited here on Earth from the exploding stars that they speculate existed and exploded. It doesn't seem really feasible to me. But I have to tell you, your theory about us coming from Orion, being captured by Sirius A and B, and then being kicked into this elliptical orbit with this sun, that's also pretty much out on the front bumper, isn't it?
That's the only explanation I could come up with. I looked for that stellar explosion that would fit the timeline, and it is the Barnard's Loop. It left a debris cloud around Orion, and we were much closer to it at that time because we're leaving Orion at around 19 kilometers per second. It accelerated us at a higher speed away from Orion, also that blast, I believe. And our whole local group, and that includes Cirrus A and B and Procyon and about 90 other stars that are around us, we're all interrelated gravitationally, and we're accelerating away from Orion. And some of us, some of the stars, I don't think were born there. I think they were swapped into our galaxy at different times. I know this is all really hard to grasp, but, you know, when you got these giant red stars, it's generally accepted the fact that they are the ones that, when they become 50% iron, when they explode, they create the higher elements. And given the number of higher elements that we have on Earth, that means Earth is very, very old. And it has been bombarded a great deal. If you go on Google Earth and start looking for mountain ranges that have a constant radius, you'll find them all over the planet, much like the moon. They're just hidden under vegetation. Or, you know, just look for constant radiuses.
Okay, so explain that to us. What do you mean when you say a constant radius for a mountain range?
Well, all your mountain ranges, a lot of them on the North Slope, Brooks Range, around Prince William Sound in Alaska, they're like a bullseye. And it liquefies the rock. These ancient meteorites were coming in at 100,000 miles an hour, maybe 100 miles in diameter, 200 miles in diameter. They liquefy the crust of the Earth, and it's thrown up in a wave, creating a range of mountains with a constant radius. It's a circular crater.
Oh, now see, that's something I had not heard before.
Well, just go on Google Earth and check it out, and that's what I did, you know. And it was beat up pretty bad during the planet formation. And I don't know, when we got the atmosphere, I think we've had different atmospheres at different times. It depends on what kind of frozen meteorites come in, too, you know. If some of the ice particles are coming in. NASA tallied up, there's 3 million or so 20-ton ice blobs coming into Earth every year, and they don't know where they're coming from. I've got two guys that are tallying them up, and they get satellites watching these things, and they even notice that they sort of dodge around our satellites. It's pretty weird, but anyway, you know, the carbon is formed by old stars, and it have to become a giant red star, and then it either explodes or can just burn out. Now, our sun is right on the borderline where it could expand into a giant red, but I don't think it'll go supernova. It might encompass the orbit of the Earth when it expands, or it might just burn out and become a red dwarf when it burns up with all its hydrogen and helium. It's not really that big compared with other stars. Now, Cirrus B, you see, was 6 solar masses. So it produced a lot of titanium and other higher elements when it exploded. It actually metallized Cirrus A's atmosphere. It's got a titanium atmosphere on Cirrus A. And so it must have been kind of close. Now, how it got into orbit around Cirrus B, A, that close, between 8 to 12 AU, astronomical units, is anybody's guess. You know, one for the listeners, is one astronomical unit is 93 million miles. It's a huge, massive star. It's a very little object the size of our Earth, but it says its mass, 1.5 solar masses in orbit, Cirrus A, 8 to 12 AU. Eight times away, further away from our sun than our Earth.
Uh-huh. All right. And, well, I'm curious about the atmosphere situation here on Earth, because within the last 6 months or so, a report has come out from a team of scientists that say, and it was a peer-reviewed paper and published in I forget which journal. But they said that they were able to determine that the Earth's atmosphere at 500,000 years after Earth was formed, 500,000 years, that's not very many, was the atmosphere, the composition of the atmosphere was pretty much the same as it is now.
Where did the oxygen come from?
Well, that's a mystery. They don't know where the oxygen came from. But it didn't come from the long process of animals or plants and animals giving off oxygen as a byproduct, because at 500,000 years, we had it.
Maybe we've had more than one life cycle on the planet where different atmospheres at different times.
I would think that's likely. I would think that's likely. Now, see, I was thinking about this when you were telling us that there are in the Orion system and in the Sirius system, there are planets out there that there may be planets that are very much like Earth. Okay. Well, is it possible that Earth, with its oxygen, its early oxygen, and perhaps plant life, perhaps animal life, in the very, very early stages, underwent a great cataclysm in the Orion system that installed that heavy CO2 atmosphere as it booted us out of the system? Is that a possibility?
I believe, yeah, because during that Huronian glaciation, the atmosphere is really thick because a lot of the ice probably was frozen CO2.
Uh-huh.
It'd been much probably like Callisto with an ocean of ice and carbon dioxide.
And for our listeners who may not be familiar with this, let me tell you that CO2 is heavier than air. If you have a CO2 tank that leaks, you'll see this fog all near the ground. It's heavier than air. It doesn't float off up into the atmosphere. So that means if you have an atmosphere that's about, I think you said, 2,800 miles thick of mostly CO2, it's going to be thick, heavy fog, and it displaces oxygen. CO2 it's not poisonous, but it will displace the oxygen.
Right. You know, let me clarify something for your listeners. In ancient times, Earth could have had up to a 20% CO2 atmosphere, but right now it is 0.033% of our atmosphere. Whereas oxygen is over 20% and nitrogen is 78%. So in other words, carbon dioxide is a trace gas of 0.033%. And we depend on carbon dioxide to grow our food. If we don't have that, you don't eat. And also, if humans could double it, it would be 0.066% of our atmosphere, and it would still be a trace gas. But your garden would grow better. So maybe humans are doing the right thing by releasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's warming the planet to where plants can grow. We just need more light coming in and the right frequency to make plants grow. You see, sun isn't a very good grow light, by the way.
Okay, so we got our carbon before we arrived in our current location. We'll be back right after this, folks. We do have to step away for a break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm delighted you're here. And my sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from that first hour. And my best hopes, wishes, prayers, and energies are all directed toward hoping that you never have to suffer the tragedy of missing a first hour again. And we'll see how that goes. We're talking this evening with Captain Hank Kroll, Henry Kroll. He is the author of Cosmological Ice Ages. And he is talking about a part of the research in that book having to do with how we got the carbon here. As we went away for break, Henry, we were talking about the possibility that the Earth has undergone several life cycles. Is it not possible that this could account for really very ancient civilizations, or for us it seems ancient? You know, in South Africa, miners digging in the Precambrian strata found some little spheres that some of them about the size of a golf ball, some of them a little larger. And they have around the equator of the sphere a machined groove. Some of them have three grooves around that equator. So obviously, now that's at Precambrian, 2.8 billion years ago. Obviously, there was someone on this planet with ability to machine things 2.8 billion years ago, because they created these things, they made these things, whatever they're for, we don't know. And there they are in the Precambrian strata 2.8 billion years ago, but those people and their civilization are nowhere to be found. But there's some leftovers from somebody being here. Is it possible that we've been through several stages where the planet was livable and there was population and maybe advanced population, advanced civilization, and then they got wiped out by whatever forces?
They found human tracks with dinosaur tracks. And I believe that, dinosaurs are probably put on here. It's a big hunting preserve. That's what it looks like. You know, they probably killed them all off, or they may have wiped them off for some other purpose later on, you see, to put humans on the planet. The reptiles ruled this place for 160 million years.
Yeah, but I'm talking about 2.8 billion years ago.
Right. I saw those objects, and I think they're toys. They look exactly like a moon of Saturn called Enceladus.
Yeah.
I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but this moon has three grooves on it. It looks perfectly, and it's, I don't know, about the quarter of the size of the Earth, and it's the grooves, the center one, is 60 miles high, and it's got two other grooves that are lower, and it goes right around the equator. It's perfectly straight all the way around. It looks like a nut of some kind, or like those toys that they dug up in South Africa. It looks exactly like that. Mm-hmm. And a closer examination of the surface of that moon, it appears that there are square foundation of housing or something on the surface. You know, nature doesn't make square foundations, but the surface is littered with them. And why one side of it is black and the other side of it is covered with ice, or it's white? Maybe they had a racial war there. They had to keep them separated, so they built a 60-mile-high wall. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, these are indeed great mysteries, and they are mysteries that I don't know that we ever will get the definitive answer. But what you're saying, though, definitively, is that the carbon did not come from our sun.
No, the sun doesn't make carbon. It's made out of hydrogen and helium. It's making helium, actually, but with the product of fusion. Yeah, but there are a lot of carbon objects out there in space.
Mm-hmm.
They found some meteorites that landed in South America. They don't know when, but they are a meter square cubes of black diamonds. And in order to make a black diamond that size, it wouldn't form on the surface of the Earth. It had to come from somewhere else. They speculate that it had to come from space somewhere. So this would indicate that there are black dwarf stars out there, old stars or red dwarfs that cooled off and cooked away for billions and billions of years, and they were high to high carbon content, and they made these huge diamonds. And they actually cut some of those diamonds up and they used them to build the Panama Canal on their tools. That's the information that I have.
Okay, you and I will continue our conversation. I do want to invite our audience to join us tonight, folks. We have to do that flip-flop thing with the telephone numbers, because the telephone number that you normally call on is the one I'm having to use to talk with Henry Kroll. And so the number that is available for you to call in is 623-237-3814. 623-237-3814. Unfortunately, as people call in, we will hear beeping, but there's nothing I can do about that except reach over and click it off. But also, those of you who are outside of the USA and outside of Canada, we'd like to invite you to join the conversation here tonight with your questions, with your comments. And you can call the number 623-237-3814. Or you, if you're outside the USA and you're outside of Canada, you may use the flash message feature on our website. So just get over to the website, scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show, and right above it is a link that says Flash Message. So just click that, and you can participate in the conversation tonight. All right, so what happens as we get back to Sirius A and B? What's going to happen to Earth? What's going to happen to the sun?
Nothing. It just thaws the ice caps back, and the oceans start producing diatoms like crazy because the incoming UV light is doubled. The amount of, and the forests and the trees and grass will start to grow. And the actually Earth heats up, the water evaporates, goes in the atmosphere and forms clouds. But the problem we've got right now is in ancient times we had more atmosphere than we do now. We've lost about 98% of our air on this planet, I believe, if it started out at 750 PSI, so it's down to 14.5 pounds per square inch, and that is our radiation shield. You see, it's equivalent to almost 4 feet of lead as far as cosmic rays go, our 60 miles of atmosphere. And it's also our meteor shield. And there are objects around there. There's the Kuiper belts of a Sirius system, plus our own Kuiper belt and meteor belts that would interact with this other star system, and Earth will get pelted again with smaller meteorites. I don't think there will be any bigger ones, but we don't need to worry because that's a few thousand years when we get closer to Sirius A and B. It'll be 14,000 years from now. But we are in danger of coronal mass ejections from our sun because of the thin atmosphere.
Okay, now, does a return to Sirius kind of serve as a recharge for the Earth?
Yeah, that's what made the layers of coal that I see down in Homer. There's 58 layers of coal. They drilled down through there, University of Alaska. They tallied up all this stuff, and they tried to date the layers. But they can't date the coal because it's more than the carbon-14 dating process will allow. It goes back. And so what they do is they try to date the schists in the micas on top of the coal layers using potassium-argon dating methods, and it's just not adequate to get a good date because that stuff could have been formed 3 or 4 or 5 million years earlier. I believe those layers of coal represent orbits around the Sirius system. Each time we get and they're thicker down deeper and thinner near the top. Also, if you go online and look at the Antarctic ice core graphs, you'll see that the amount of carbon dioxide and those squiggles on those graphs get closer together in ancient times, 400,000 years ago. They're about 105,000 years apart, the ice age temperature graphs, and they get closer together as you go back in time, which means that our orbit period is degenerating. We go out further and further away from our host stars, Sirius A and B, and we go out where it's cold in space and the Earth freezes up for longer periods of time. It's about 3 million years ago, we got blasted out of orbit by the Bernard's Loop explosion, and the first ice ages were maybe 500 years that we had small ice caps on the poles. And then they went 500, 800 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years. Now they last 105,000 or 110,000 years, where most of the Earth is covered with ice down, you know. So
right.
It's just that we've been terraformed by our own moon.
All right, let's go to the telephone. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller.
Kevin, can you hear
me? Okay, cannot hear the caller. All right, let me try to fix that. So, caller, let me invite you to call us back, and we'll see if we can adjust that where we can hear you. All right, I think I have adjusted it. All right, let's see. I think, yep. Okay, we're good to go. 623-237-3814. Caller, give it another shot, okay? And don't forget, those of you outside of the USA and outside of Canada, you can use the flash message feature. All right, so should we expect ice ages to continue, or should we expect that as we travel towards Sirius A and B,
all the planets seem to be warming up and losing their ice caps. Even Mars warming up, and it'd be nice if it had more atmosphere. We could go over there and colonize it. But anyway, it needs volcanism, see?
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, we're going to lose our ice cap, and sea levels will rise eventually, but not right away. It'll be hundreds of years, you know. And we just have to build our houses on piling. I have a house on piling.
Yeah.
And
well, you know, my home is in Thailand, and where I live, where my house is, almost all of the houses in the village are up on stilts, if you will. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. If you will, tell us your first name and from where are you calling.
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Brent, we can barely hear you.
Yeah, ain't workarounds fun. Cause things right next to my mouth.
Yeah, go ahead.
Henry, I'm not going to dispute your research because I haven't done any myself. However, I'm going to ask you, what is the possibility that the Earth in its original form was primarily carbon and that the cosmic interactions with it and the chemical reactions have created all this other stuff?
Whatever the Earth is made out of was where it came from, the same elements or DNA of space, I think. It's possible there was a lot of carbon in that area. There's no way to tell where, you know, we were born over there in Orion someplace. Exactly where, I don't know, you know. There's a possibility it was a collection of old burnout red dwarf stars with lots of carbon. And there's a lot of rogue planets out there. They're finding thousands of them. Who knows where they came from? You know, our galaxy, by the way, has eaten up 10 other major galaxies. It gobbles each other up. You got a book titled Galaxies. Timothy Ferris wrote it. There's many, many pictures of these things eating one another and computer simulations of what they look like afterwards. Also, there's... Go ahead.
No, we're listening to you. Go ahead.
We've also eaten up 100,000 smaller star clusters or more, maybe a million. We don't know. And Sirius A and B are probably assimilated by our own galaxy from somewhere else, because Sirius B, we weren't near it when it exploded. It could have been captured after we left our birthplace in Orion by our own galaxy, and then we got manipulated where we got to... captured by it, and that's what created life on Earth and gave us our coal, carbon resources, our coal, oil, and limestone through photosynthesis, taking the air down and laying it down, you see.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. All right.
By the way, what makes this, people don't understand this when I mention these things, and goes, but when you're driving your car down the road, that's photosynthesis energy. It was made by diatoms in ancient times in the seas, this oil that was turned into gasoline. And coal is also plants that were crushed down. Hard coal is a 40-to-1 compression ratio, and soft coal is about 20-to-1. So in other words, 5 feet of... or 1 foot of soft coal is 20 foot of plant growth, and we're not seeing that right now on Earth. No, there's no coal being made right now. We have to be somewhere where there's more incoming UV light, and we've got to have carbon dioxide, of course. So, anyway.
Okay, now, earlier, you made the comment that our sun is not a very good grow light. Why is that?
Well, it takes UV light to penetrate the oceans in a very intense UV light to get the plankton to grow. They've done a lot of studies on diatoms, and they evolve different shapes to absorb different wavelengths of light in the ocean, so they don't even compete for the same photons. They're like little snowflakes of different shapes, and they can fill up an ocean in a couple of weeks. Given 20, they can multiply 8 times in 24 hours given adequate carbon dioxide and enough photons for 24 hours. And when you're in a multiple star system with lights coming in from 2 or 3 different places, these diatoms can really, maybe a month or two, fill up an entire ocean with diatomaceous earth, and then it's compressed down and limestone sheets are laid over it, and then it's combined with hydrogen in the water, and you've got crude oil hydrocarbons.
So, what is our future looking like here?
Pardon?
What is our future looking like?
Well, we're going to be lining up here with the center of the galaxy between the sun and Sagittarius A, they call it. There's a 3 million solar mass black hole there in the middle. But we've got some dark matter in between, and I'm just hoping that that dark matter will shield us from the cosmic rays. And we're in this orbit where we go below the galactic plane, and we come up and line up with it. Well, we're going to line up with the galactic plane and Sagittarius A and the sun and on November 21st, or December 21st, 2012. So, you know, the ancients had this all figured out. I don't know. Mayans and the Aztec calendars point to this point in time. I don't know if it's going to be the end time or the beginning. It's hard to tell. We've lost most of our radiation shield, about 98% of it. We're down to 14 pounds per square inch or thereabouts at sea level.
Well, and our magnetic field, which shields us from radiation, has been getting weaker and more rapidly getting weaker over the past...
Yes, it's weakening.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe that is caused by iron meteorites in the Earth. It's like an electric motor. The Earth is like an electric motor. It's got these huge magnetic iron meteorites in the magnetic pole, and it rotates once every 24 hours, produces a nice magnetic field, which allows us to navigate and birds to navigate, and it's weakening for some reason. It has to do with the sun. It will reverse its magnetic pole when the sun reverses its magnetic pole. It seems to be tied in with the sun.
Have you noticed in your work as a commercial fisherman and as a ship's captain in that industry, you're out there on the water, you have to be able to navigate. Have you noticed any differences in navigation over the past few years?
Well, the magnetic pole of the Earth is weakening, and my autopilot doesn't work with the darn. It's based on a compass, sort of a small compass, the one I have in the boat, and it has a computer that monitors the angle of the rudder, and I've got a rheostat back there, sends the information back to the computer, and it, based on this little compass, and I had to take it apart a few years ago, because it had four little wires that are attached to the card, and they're little curly-cue things, so small I could barely see them, and I had to solder one of those back. I went to bed and woke up the next morning, and I filed a 16-penny nail into a point and made a soldering iron out of it and laid my hands on the tables to make them steady so I could solder it back together, and was able to. It's still working today, believe it or uh-huh. not.
Okay, but have you noticed any differences in navigation?
Yes, it's not keeping a very good course. It's more erratic every year. It used to be real sensitive, and now it just wanders. It tends to wander a lot more.
All right, so what's going to happen if we go through a magnetic pole shift so that what is now North Pole will be South Pole? Now, I'm not talking about the Earth flipping, but a magnetic pole shift.
Right, right.
So what's going to happen to navigation at that point?
Well, we use other forms. We've got gyro compasses. We can set those before we leave port and tie them into our existing systems. We've also got, maybe we got the internet, or I mean the GPS satellite. I have a GPS also that we use, you know. Mm-hmm. You can also tie that into your GPS. The autopilot has all of those NEMA codes and stuff where you can plug it in. But, you know, it won't affect us so much, but migrating birds might have a difficulty finding where they lay their nests if they have a small amount of magnetite in their brains or in their head that they take on, and it allows them to fly a course. We've got Arctic terns that travel 27,000 miles from South America all the way to the Arctic every year. And another migrating waterfowl, I don't know what they're going to do, but they've survived before, I believe. Apparently the Earth's magnetic field is swapped.
Now we have to step away from break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. See if you can find your telephone.
Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Henry Kroll. And Henry, we have a flash message from James in the UK. It's kind of long. Let me summarize it. He says that when you were talking about those spheres that were found in South Africa, you said they look like toys to you. And during that answer, you mentioned that the dinosaurs you thought maybe were put here as, you know, big game hunting preserve. And what he wants to know is, does this indicate that you think that there is intelligent extraterrestrial life out there somewhere?
Well, definitely there is. We are the extraterrestrials. according to Zachariah Sitchin, the Anunnaki came here in spaceships filled with water and took on a voyage of 8 years it took them to get here from ancient Sumerian writings. And I believe they came from the Sirius system because there's a water planet over there. And they're not the only ones. We're being visited by from all over. There's probably 60 different places that they come here. The U.S. government, if you go online and, oh boy, now I can't remember the name. But anyway, the U.S. government made a deal with aliens way back in the 60s where they would send 12 people to the planet Serpo. And you type in Serpo in Google and read that, and you can decide yourself whether it's fake or not. Possibly it is, but I don't think so, because the planet that they took them to was sparsely populated. It had smaller than Earth, very hot, more like Arizona weather, and it had 500,000 people or aliens living on it. They didn't allow the folks to take pictures of their children. They kept them away from them, and they were allowed to carry a pistol. There was two women, and one of them died over there, I guess, and one of them stayed there, the scientist, didn't leave. The rest of them came back, I guess, eight of them arrived back here 10 years later, 10-year voyage. It's 30 light years, 35 light years. Took them 6 months, or 9 months to get there, and they were sick the whole time and nauseated. And when they came back, they made it in a lot quicker with a bigger ship. But anyway, that's all online. I don't know much about it other than what I've read on the subject. But there's been so many, you know, sightings of ships and people taken up in them, and also enough evidence out there, pictures and information, all the also technology that we got from the somewhere that disappeared, you know, your fiber optic cables and whatever else is used to make something invisible to gravity. That there had to be lots of visitations. I mean, in the past, and also throughout history, you've got ancient paintings in Europe on the wall with objects up there in the sky. But Da Vinci and other artists have painted this stuff in churches. And, you know, the Bible talks about Ezekiel and Jesus being taken up from the top of the pyramid, even. I can't remember the Bible verses right at the present time, but I talked about it on an earlier broadcast.
You know, one of those pictures that you're talking about, if you go online, folks, and you look for it, one of these ancient paintings with a UFO, is in a monastery, and it's in a monastery in the former Yugoslavia. I've been in that monastery, and I saw the painting and did not notice that. I didn't know about that, Henry, till I got back here to the United States, and several years later saw that online. I said, well, I've been there, I've seen that, but I did not notice that UFO in the sky, and nobody pointed it out to me. You know, I was just in there visiting and looking at this old monastery, and but I've been in there. And the painting is there. I just was, my mind was not thinking to look for something like that, you know.
Well, I think a lot of that was destroyed, all of this connections we had with the ETs. They didn't want to, and all the monuments that they built in England and all over, they're shaped like big flying saucers, the earthworks. I think they were designed to draw the ETs down here so they could either eat them or steal their technology. I think they were hungry at the time, so they probably ate a lot of space gods. God literally is in you. So, the Doga, or the little guys over at Crash in China, you know, they were in they were killing them and eating them over there a long time ago, 13,000 years ago or something, but the chiefs kept some of these little lizard guys as pets, It was about that time that China developed all of their technology. They had gunpowder, and everything that we have today was sort of appeared over there in China at that time. All of the inventions, anyway.
We have a flash message from Paul in Australia, and he wants to know if you have ever personally seen a UFO or an extraterrestrial.
Well, I've never seen an extraterrestrial. I've seen objects move in the sky that defy all logic. You know, meteors don't change course and move at very high speed or accelerate, you know, away from the central point. But that's about all I've seen. You know, I've been down in Arizona and sleeping in the desert or camped out down there, and I've seen a lot of stuff. But I haven't, I can't really say it's an alien or anything like that. It could be, you know, but I've seen a lot of the videos that NASA had taken from the, I guess it was STS-48, the shuttle transfer mission where they had the tether experiment. I have those two videos there that show these large objects 3 miles in diameter. They're circular with a hole in the middle and a bite cut out of the side like a cookie with a bite out of it. And they can peer magically out of nowhere, out of a higher energy state, and lower themselves down to where they can observe our tether satellite. They had a 12-mile-long cable on a thin wire about a 16th of an inch in diameter, and a rocket that strung it out in the ionosphere to measure the voltage up there on this mission, shuttle transfer mission. And they activated this thing, 12-mile cable, and they were taking pictures of it from 40 and 50 miles away with a Columbia.
As a matter of fact,
there with a handheld video camera.
As a matter of fact, the cable was glowing so brightly.
Like jellyfish. And I believe they're either living things or there are people living on board. They seem to be quite intelligent. They were some switches. They retrieved the satellite. Some switches on the satellite had been thrown, toggle switches. Also, there were some CO2 tanks had been emptied on there.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. On the tether experiment, that tether was glowing so brightly that you could see it from Earth with the naked eye.
They measured 12 million volts.
And it was the size of a matchstick. It was no bigger around than a matchstick, but it was glowing so brightly that you could see it from Earth, and I saw it, and I was amazed.
Like a light bulb filament, you see, filament of a light bulb only stretched out straight.
Yeah, and it was 12 miles long, and. Now, you know what was kind of interesting, you described how the these objects that were seen and videotaped in that experiment were 3 miles in diameter, had a hole in the center and a notch out of the side. What's very interesting is if you watch that, there's at least one of them that you can see moving from lower left to upper right, and the notch, it morphs. The notch at the back of it closes, and the notch on the front of it opens.
Right. Now, some of them had 4 notches, and some of them had 2 notches, and some of them appeared to be a groove that extended around the radius. And also got pictures of on my computer of other ones that were photographed from the ground over England and other places.
All right, I want to go back to carbon for a minute. On this planet, all life is carbon-based. As far as we know, all life is carbon-based. Do you think it's possible that there's life out there on other planets, other places out there in space, that would be based on something other than carbon?
Yeah, it's possible. I think that some of the objects that we see like ghosts or these little orbs that float around are plasma. and there are sort of intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I tape recorded a guy in Florida, lived in Arta, Florida. He was 8 years old, but all these little guys would play out in the street, and there would be ball lightning out there some days, and they'd try to catch the ball lightning. They didn't know any better. And they could never catch it, of course. They wouldn't hurt the children. But then there was a guy who lived right across the street from him, a mean guy, and he'd swear at him and stuff, yell at the kids, and the ball light, he was leaning on his porch railing, and the ball lightning hit the porch railing and went along it and went up through his chest, and it killed him instantly, and he went over the railing onto the street, dead. And then his house caught fire immediately afterwards and burnt to the ground. So, you know, also they've seen objects or similar enter a church. They have them as regular happenings down in Oklahoma and places. They call them, what do they call those? I can't remember now, but, oh yeah, glory cloud.
Uh-huh.
Now what is that? You know, it's a bunch of plasma of some kind, ordered plasma with some sort of intelligence. I wrote a book called Philosopher's Stone about 25 years ago, and it's based on M-State or ORMs, ORM matter. Apparently, in between our matter is a lot of orbitally rearranged elements in the form of combined atoms that don't attract to gravity because the electrons are orbiting in a ring and they're anti-gravity. David Hudson has a patent on this stuff, and it's used by your body for longevity and increased intelligence, by the way. You eat this stuff all the time. The plants utilize it for cell division. You use it for cell division. It's a whole new science, or science isn't up on it. I don't think they ever will be. They don't want to discover it or go do the... But it's been in our history. Even the ancient Hebrews used this stuff. They had it in their priest bread to make the priests live longer and keep them more intelligent. You know, the pharaohs and the rulers in ancient times ate this stuff. And they take it out of the soil using alkaline. Plants use alkaline, by the way. It's the same process. But that's a different book. It's titled Philosopher's Stone. And there's recipes in there to make the stuff. You can watch them on YouTube, too.
What's the connection there with these orbs?
Now, there's so much plasma in the universe that there's probably intelligent plasma blobs out there, you know, or even... And they come out of the earth, they can go right through our matter, they can live in the earth or underneath it someplace, and come out of there anytime they want, travel through our so-called third-dimensional matter.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this break. Don't go away. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Henry Kroll, better known, I think, as Captain Hank Kroll. And we began talking about the mystery of carbon on this planet. So let me ask you a question related to the carbon. And that is, does the carbon play any role at all in the plasma?
No, I don't believe so. Plasma is one of the most abundant things in the universe. All the stars are made out of it. You know, it's just free electrons and free particles. Carbon formation is somewhere near iron somewhere, after iron. In the periodic table of elements, you'd have to go look at temperatures and also, you know, fusion temperatures to figure it out, but I'm not up on that. I will comment on how many million BTUs there's 5.8 million BTUs in one barrel of oil, for you guys that are into math. we're burning 100 billion barrels a day. So how much heat is released every day from the burning of oil? And is that enough to affect the climate on Earth over a long period of time? When China goes online and with their new coal plants and stuff, you know, these are questions that I put in the book for you to do your own research. I'm just furnishing the data here. You know, I'm trying to make people think and do their own math in this book. It's titled Cosmological Ice Ages. It's a huge book, 8.5 by 11, almost 400 pages. It's about half a ream of paper. And anyway, your fossil fuels have radium in it. They don't want to talk about that. The government doesn't even mention that at all. It's 60 times more radioactive than uranium, by the way, and it gives off radon gas. And your coal burning plants are using the best collective air filters to get this deadly radium out of the air, but the leftover soot in the collectors is burned in landfills. And nobody wants to talk about that sort of thing. There are, you know, 21,000 deaths per year in the U.S. from radon gas, and radium is 400,000 deaths worldwide. Can you imagine what a reaction it would be if five people died from bird flu? You know, they lock everybody in cages in the U.S. The bugs, you know, these bug numbers that I put in the book there about one-third of the deaths of auto accidents are from use of coal and oil. I mean, this thing is full of statistics. I was trying to figure out if humans can contribute to global warming, and I don't think they do. The bigger forces are gravitation and sun and other moon gravity and that sort of thing that regulate the climate. And volcanoes. Volcanoes are the big ones. They release a tremendous amount of CO2, and every time they do, it lowers global temperature. It doesn't raise it. There isn't a greenhouse effect from carbon dioxide at all. What it is the ash, the carbon ash from burning things and stuff also tends to exclude light from the surface of the planet, and it cools things down.
All right, so as
we could be doing the right thing by burning the coal and the oil, but we just don't know. We're not smart enough to figure this stuff out as humans. See, we're not. And by the way, humans aren't native to this planet. If you don't believe me, take off all your clothes and you go out in the woods and just see how long you'll survive out there. You know, if you were from this planet, you'd have different teeth where you could eat different foods instead of the genetically modified stuff that has been genetically modified for thousands of years. And also, we'd have fur or some kind of coating on the outside of us to allow us to survive. We are genetically inbred from someone, from somewhere else, with some native species to be able to survive on this planet. You see, if you're going to another planet, you just can't drop off there and expect to live, because the atmosphere would be different, different atmospheric pressures, different temperatures, different composition. So you'd have to modify whoever you dropped off there genetically so that they could survive. And that's us. We've been modified genetically. There's no modern way to figure out where we came from. It just suddenly appeared about 100,000 years ago, modern Cro-Magnon man. And by the way, he had a bigger brain than we do, and it's probably smarter. So we're devolving. We're losing our atmosphere. It's 98% gone. We've lost our radiation shield, meteor shield. So I don't want to sound too doom and gloom here, but we need to become conscious, you see what I mean?
Yeah, things are not headed the direction that most people have been led to believe they are headed. And that's important. There is a scientist that we have had some contact with. His name is Dr. Lachezar Filipov. He recently did an interview on television. He's from Bulgaria. He did the interview there. And in the course of that interview, he said that at the current rate of using up Earth's resources, will be done, no more resources to use within the next 200 years. And he said, if there are extraterrestrials, that tells us there is another way to do things. There's another path to go.
Yeah.
And sounds like your book is kind of along that, kind of in that light as well.
I'm just trying to make people aware of where we're going and, you know, what we're doing. We're just not even fully conscious. You know, and we've been modified genetically to be a slave race, it appears.
Uh-huh.
So that we will either worship a single god or gods, and we're spend all our time on our knees instead of using our brain. Now, if, you know, using basic logic, if you use the Bible as a reference there, by the way, God supposedly created mankind in his image, or the gods did, whichever way you want to put it, in plural, in the ancient Hebrew, Elohim is plural. So, anyway, if that's true, then he gave us a brain, and he'd probably expect us to use this thing that we got up there. You know, but nobody wants to do that. They'd rather be more subservient and worship their creators. And that would kind of make a god angry, I would think. Maybe all these subservient morons around him bowing all the time, it would just be irritating, you see. That's probably why he doesn't hang out here. if you were a god, you wouldn't be able to take that sort of thing very long. You know, you'd start wiping out whole cities or something, you know, and come back and destroy the planet and start over.
Well, so I'll tell you what, Henry, we're just...
by a race that took off and went somewhere.
We are just about out of time, and I want to thank you for being with me on tonight's show. It's been absolutely fascinating. And if you will, just stay on the line with me for a minute. I want to chat with you after we get off of the air. All right, folks. Captain Hank Kroll, Henry Kroll, and the name of the book is Cosmological Ice Ages. There is a link to it on Amazon on my website. So if you click where it says Show Info, it'll pop open a little window. And that little window it pops open has a link to the book. And you can go over there and get you a copy of it and read it. Cosmological Ice Ages. There's some fascinating theories in that book. He's been with us before, Henry Kroll has, and we've talked about a lot of different things that are addressed in that book. Tonight, the role of carbon, maybe you think that's not all that exciting, but you know something? Without it, you don't exist. And according to Henry, it doesn't come from our solar system. It doesn't come from our sun. It doesn't make carbon. And so, you know, as he said, you are the extraterrestrials. That's going to do it. That's a wrap for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You, well, you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.